The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
You're on Money FM, Singapore's most influential radio station. I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Today, a special focus on an entrepreneur and entrepreneurship. He's best known as being a former PAP Member of Parliament, but did you know that he's also a serial entrepreneur? He turned 62 earlier this month and has six companies under his belt. He's spoken in Parliament on entrepreneurship and in the community is known for being the voice that encourages startups. He is founding member of ACE, that is the Action Community for Entrepreneurship, which aims to be the national voice for the Singapore startup ecosystem. Now, his new 500-page book grew out of the speeches that he wrote on entrepreneurship. Writing really clarifies our ideas, right? And he hopes that anyone will be able to use the ideas in this book to think like an entrepreneur, no matter what their day job is. Welcome, Professor Inderjit Singh, author of The Art and Science of Entrepreneurship. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle, and thank you for having me here today.
It's a great pleasure to speak with you. Professor, the pandemic has disrupted supply chains. It's really called into question entire industries, infrastructure, whether enough has been invested in oil and gas, for example. What do you think entrepreneurs need to understand about transformation in this new era?
Okay. You know, actually, we've already facing the disruption caused by Industry 4.0. And Industry 4.0 created many new things, especially technology was disrupting. The pandemic came, and that's another disruption. And then all the war and the geopolitics that is going to be realigned. So I see this is an era where we're going to see a complete realignment of supply chains and complete realignment of opportunities too. So while it's a very challenging environment, the entrepreneur in me tells me that, you know, we all should look out for the opportunities amid these challenges and to see, you know, how we can participate in the new era that's coming that will result in a complete realignment of supply chain. And I think, you know, it's tough, but it's also something that I see as an opportunity.
What are the key sectors that Singapore has been supporting pre-pandemic? And do any of these need to shift now that we're seeing a sort of realignment of supply chains, as you point out, in this new era?
Yeah, so one of the things that we all have been used to is to rely on China as a factory of the world for many of our businesses, you know, and so I too do business and I rely on China for some of my production of my goods. So this is something that I think with the disruptions that happened in China, the lockdowns of the ports, lockdown cities, many companies are looking at new places to do their production. And so we also, I think, while we were giving up on manufacturing, I think Singapore has an opportunity to bring back some manufacturing to Singapore, the high-end part of it. And today with robotics and with AI and with automation, some of it we can do here effectively. We can do everything, but I think, you know, this is something that the government should relook at, that can we bring some manufacturing back to Singapore? I suggested this a couple of years ago when the pandemic started. Happy to know that the Minister for Trade Industry, Minister Chan at that time, actually has made a point that in next 10 years, he wants to increase the manufacturing content of Singapore GDP. So I think we're heading in the right direction now.
Do you have hope that we'll see homegrown MNCs, homegrown manufacturers in this vein that you're sharing with us?
Yes, and I think there is an opportunity in a few places. One of it is that our universities and our research institutes have done a lot of research. So we spend billions of dollars every year to do research. But we have not successfully transformed this research into economic value, which means created companies out of the research. So I see an opportunity for Singapore companies to be formed out of the research. So commercialization of research. And this could, what I call them, the startup or prototype factories of the world, can be something that Singapore can play a very important role in. So a technology that goes into prototyping before it goes into mass production. So I think, you know, this is something that our entrepreneurs here should be looking at. Our SME should be working with a research institute and see what they can do to improve their own processes so that they can be the ones that do these things.
Is the support for local companies adequate to provide meaningful jobs for Singaporeans?
Okay, one of the worries I have for Singapore is this, that we have had this multinationals first policy for a long time. And during the pandemic, many companies were looking for a stable place to place their operation. And so we continue to attract many MNCs. Not necessarily a bad thing, it's good for us. But when things get back to normal, some of these MNCs may relocate back to other places. And when that happens, and if we don't have enough of our local enterprises that can create the jobs that will be displaced, then I think we'll be in a lot of trouble. So therefore, I think there's room for us, the government and all of us, to do a lot more in strengthening our SMEs so that they can become the MNCs of the future with a Singapore home base, supporting the region or the world, but then creating jobs for Singaporeans. So I think in the long term, we have to do more in equalizing the kind of support that we give to MNCs compared to what we give to SMEs.
What needs to be done in this area of greater support for local MNCs?
One of the things that recently has been done, Enterprise Singapore has embarked on an entrepreneurship leadership transformation program. Now, I think this is something that's very useful. It brings SMEs that are already in operation, small ones, and working with the universities, going through a one-year program and showing them how to transform their businesses, teaching them how to transform, attaching mentors to them, and then helping them, you know, to think of out of the box and see how they can pivot and try to become bigger companies, perhaps the MNC sort of. So I think this is an excellent program that has been done. The other area that we have to watch very carefully is going to be the area of supporting them in financing. As it is right now, the big companies have no problem getting good financing from banks and from private equities. But the small and medium enterprises, after they have gone through the startup phase, in the growth stage, they still find it very difficult to find money to go in growth. The new area that has become a big problem for us is cost of business here. Cost has risen so high, I'm afraid that some of our SMEs and our startups may not thrive for a long time. And the final thing is manpower. We have tightened foreign manpower recruitment, and this could spell trouble for some SMEs. I think we need to rebalance. We cannot say no foreigners. At the same time, we cannot have too many of them. So finding the right balance is a challenge that the government faces. And if we can find the right balance, I think we'll be okay.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience as an entrepreneur. You're best known as being a former politician in Singapore's parliament, representing Ang Mo Kio GRC from 1996 to 2015. But you also founded United Test and Assembly Center, or UTAC, and that's a semiconductor firm. And that was back in 1998 when you founded it. It became a unicorn valued at $2 billion 3 years later. It's now a $500 billion industry globally, the semiconductor industry. How are you able to spot this opportunity back in 1998?
Many people advised me not to do it. In fact, they thought it was a crazy thing to do. Because at that time, when I was planning to start the UTAC, many of the semiconductor companies were bleeding. They were losing money. And the industry was in a down cycle. But I saw, I was working for Texas Instruments before I started UTAC. So I was in the semiconductor industry. So the important thing is the domain knowledge. I knew what the industry was about. And I saw a big shift in the industry. The big shift was this, that the big semiconductor companies like Texas Instruments and Intel wanted to outsource part of their manufacturing process so that they could focus on design and some of the higher value added activities. And this was a gap that I identified. And I had the expertise because I was doing something similar in Texas Instruments. And so from there on, I started planning, came up with a business plan. And the biggest challenge I faced at that time, I could not find money in Singapore. But I managed to find it from my friends in Taiwan. But anyway, I saw an opportunity because I understood the industry. There were challenges. I mentioned early on that amid challenges, there are always opportunities. And this is what I saw. And I took the plunge. Many people thought I was crazy. But it worked. Right? Today, UTAC is still a very strong company.
If we look at the semiconductor industry and China, Bloomberg just today is writing an article that notes that most of the world's fastest growing chip firms are in China. Do you still see opportunity in this sector?
Yes, I think, you know, if you look at what we do today, live today, the IoTs, the devices, the mobile phones, we are electronically enabling everything. We may also have chips on us one day. So I think, you know, the trend at which the world is heading with AI and with computerization and automation, electronics goes into everything. Our cars is full of electronics today. So I think, you know, when you have electronic gadgets, then you need semiconductor devices. So I see a continuous growth of the semiconductor industry for some time to come, and there are tremendous opportunities. China was lagging, and they are now accelerating to try to catch up to be a key player in this industry. Singapore did well in the past. Taiwan did well. South Korea did well. US did well. So China is going to catch up. And I think it's the right thing to do because the demand is very high and they need to create their own companies that could supply the demand.
So UTAC has been listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange in 2004. You left UTAC in 2001. Is this your most successful company? You've had six. You started six, right?
Yeah. So UTAC, I would say, is the most successful. I had very strong foundations. And so now 20 over years, it's still running. And, you know, it went public. Then it was brought private. And then private equity people are holding it right now. So this is very successful because I had built a very strong foundation. In 97, just before I started UTAC, together with my brothers, I had started a company called TriStar Electronics. This company does distribution of electronic products in Africa. And so we do business in 38 countries in Africa. So it's a very challenging environment, but the business is doing well. I would say that we know Africa very well. Being Singaporeans, we can do business there. And I see tremendous opportunities in the future. That is also something that I would say I consider successful. After I left UTAC, I started another semiconductor company, Silicon Valley-based, mass production in Philippines, design centers in India and HQ in Singapore. We sold that off around 2014, 2015, trade sale rather than IPO. So that was another successful company. And then, you know, the others.
What do you consider your most successful fundraise?
The most successful fundraise is UTAC. Now, UTAC was when I started that in, I was planning it in 95, 96, while I was still in Texas, since I was planning this company. And around 96, 97, when I was ready, I started looking around for financing. I wanted to raise $100 million because I wanted to do a factory. And a semiconductor equipment can cost $2 to $3 million each. So I had that in mind. And so when I started looking, I could not find any money in Singapore. Fortunately, I had many good Taiwanese friends. I put a business plan. I took one day leave from Texas Instruments, went to Taiwan, a room full of 50 potential investors. And during that one presentation, I did it myself. I got commitment of more than $100 million. Now, I'm a Singaporean. I'm going to start a company in Singapore. So I wanted at least 30% of the company to be Singaporean owned. So I told the Taiwanese, wait for me, I'll come back to Singapore. The moment I found the money in Taiwan, there were some Singapore VCs who decided to join in. So I raised US$138 million in one go. That's a successful.
Absolutely incredible. And you must have had to take leave from Texas Instruments in order to make that presentation for the VC money. What do you say to entrepreneurs out there? What does this book say to people who think, I have a day job, you know, I can't be starting an MNC?
Oh. When everyone went back home, while I was working in Texas room, I was in my room in my own time doing my work, planning this company. All right. So I did not eat into my company work time in my own time at night. So I planned that. And then when I was ready, I must be ethical about it. I took leave and I went to make a presentation. My advice is, if you want to do this, initially you can do it the way I did. But when there comes a time that what I did, you have to immerse yourself fully in the startup. Because you cannot be a part-time thing if you want it to be successful. In the planning stages, okay, the moment company is running, you need to take care of so many things that you just have to immerse yourself, take the plunge, take the risk, and you know that's the only way to create success.
Well, speaking of risk, in your mothership interview on growing Singapore's future economy, you touched on Singaporeans being risk-averse. And you said, we are so comfortable, not willing to take the risks or the discomfort that comes with going to different places. So what do you think explains your success? You grew up in Singapore, came to Singapore as an infant at 10 months, born in Punjab. You've gone through the system here. What do you think explains your success when it comes to risk-taking?
Yeah, so I think there are two parts of this, right? One of it is people say it's a nature, right? But I believe a lot in the nurture part of it. So we grew up in a poor family. My father had two jobs. I actually in the early days, for 20 years of my life, I was staying in a quarters in a factory. My father was a watchman there. So we went through that, and the challenges. And then the aspirations to want to do better. And so, you know, and as we face all those challenges, you know, there is also opportunities that are out there. So the environment pushed me along to say, you have to try this if you want to get out of the current situation. So I think for me, it was nurture. I don't think so was nature. Otherwise, I would not have joined a multinational, spent 13 years there. I would have straight gone and tried. So I think the risk-taking thing can be push and can be pulled. There's an opportunity and you take the risk to win the opportunity. Or it's a push factor that, you know, that you have. It's an environment that pushes you to want to go and do something different.
To what extent would you say social capital, networks of relationships, is crucial for entrepreneurial success?
That's actually a very important thing, and I learned it. I've learned it over and over again. Now, so when I was going to raise the first round of funding for UTEC, my Taiwanese friends were the networks that helped me to go and create a network in Taiwan. Otherwise, I would not have known enough people down there. So this was a very important thing for me that, you know, I had a network that helped me to create success. And this was because we were in very good terms and they were willing to come in and help, and they did. When I wanted to, in UTEC, for my first customer, I wanted to target Siemens. Siemens was one of my first customers, a very big German company. I actually engaged the help of one of my professors in my university. He was he retired, and so he was a good friend as a professor. I worked with him, and I asked him to help me create a link into Siemens because he was German trained, and he had a connection, and I used his expertise. He made the introduction, and I managed to win the business. So I think social capital and networks, as we call it in the business world, are very important to create success. So I just talk about these two things, but customer connections, for example. So, you know, making a cold call is always difficult, but if someone makes a recommendation, it's a lot more easier.
So a lot of young people want to, you know, aspire to be entrepreneurs, and you just have to look at the Theranos example of a drop of blood to diagnose all sorts of diseases, Elizabeth Holmes, and you can see how social networks can be exploited. But if you don't have a business idea that is workable, you're going to, you know, be found out eventually. So what do you think of this mindset, the fake it till you make it mindset in entrepreneurship?
That is very dangerous. It won't last long. I mean, to a certain extent, many entrepreneurs fake it to the point that they may overrepresent what they are capable of doing. But there's a line to be drawn on telling a pure lie. All right. So when I start the business, I say, okay, you know, in 2 years, I'm going to do $10 million worth of business. Now, I may do $2 million, but, you know, I will say I'm doing $10 million because I want to get more money in. So that is a question of execution. But when I don't even have the capability and I say I can do it, that's a lie. So I think, you know, that will not last long. Sooner or later, you'll get discovered. And then, you know, in the long term, which I always believe, your reputation is what is most important, not the quick gains that you can get by lying. So if I have to give up something, I give up, but I will not want to damage my reputation. And that is something that's helped me along the way as I went on to start my other companies. It was a reputation that helped me.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on scaling. I spoke with a reputed economist, John A. List, recently, and he talks about how as companies scale, the initial idea tends to lose voltage. He calls it the voltage effect. What, in your opinion, is the key to scaling well?
Okay. So in my book, I have a chapter called Thinking with the Heart and Not with the Head. All right. So my point down there is that most entrepreneurs, when they start off, they start thinking with, it's like a gut feeling, think with the heart, and not a logical thinking. And so that's why they do things differently. Everyone who thinks logically, logic is quite simple. If everyone does that, then no one will achieve the breakthroughs and the disruption that comes along. So thinking with the heart and not with the head, entrepreneurs do more of that than the logic. But as the company grows bigger, there needs to be some structure. And so this structure requires a bit more logic and a bit more systems in place for you to be able to manage the bigger companies. And so this is when you start now thinking a bit more logic and with the head, and less with the heart. So many entrepreneurs continue to want to run a bigger company the way they were running when you were small, and that's when many of them fail. And I got one example that I echoed in my book, and that's Steve Jobs. When he started Apple, it was a very successful company. After some time, when he became big, he could not manage it, and he was fired. And they brought in John Sculley, and then Steve Jobs went to start another company. Along the way, Steve Jobs learned that he needed to think more with the head and less with the heart as the company becomes bigger. So when Apple rehired him, look at where Apple became. So at different stages of your startup, you need to be thinking differently. You need to be doing things differently. You need different structures. And many entrepreneurs fail to understand this. And that's the reason why many entrepreneurs, after some time, give up the job to a more structured CEO. And this is how it happens in the US. The startup CEOs don't continue to be CEOs forever. They take on advisory role. They take on the CTO role. And I think this is a good way to manage as a company grows.
And finally, before we let you go, Professor, what is your hope that readers will take from this book?
Yeah, so now one of the things, my main objective of this book was this, that I wanted to impart as much as I could to aspiring entrepreneurs. And most of the time when we read books on entrepreneurship, they are written by professors, academics. I'm not an academic, I'm an entrepreneur myself. So academic, you read the academic theories and then you have to try to think about how to put it to practice. Or if you read books written by entrepreneurs, most of the entrepreneurs write their stories. And then it's up to the entrepreneurs to try to distill out those things. What I did was I reversed. So not theory to practice, but I converted practice to theory. So basically, my point is that, you know, I'm now teaching you how I did it, but I have got some theory to it so you can learn. And in the book, I've got many real-life examples, UTEC and many other stories, including my time when I was doing my national service in the officer cadet course, how a mindset change converted me from the worst performing in my platoon to the best performing in my platoon. It was so in this book, you know, in addition to helping entrepreneurs start companies, I also am trying to get every one of us to think entrepreneurs. As I mentioned many times, it is about mindset. And so Lee Kuan Yew was an entrepreneur. There are many people, you may be a teacher, you may be anyone in life, but you can think like an entrepreneur. And once you start thinking like an entrepreneur, you can do things differently and make life better. So I'm hoping that, you know, the key takeaways is a mindset thing. Use the example to relate to the theories that I've written. And then once you're ready to start the company, I've got a lot of help on that, on how from the idea, how can you develop it further to a business model, to a business plan, and then start the company. So I've got step by step. That part I call science. The mindset portion, I call it art of entrepreneurship.
Ah, okay. I think you've just sent hundreds rushing to the bookstore to figure out what it was you learned in the army that changed your mindset from, you know, performance, not doing so great, to incredible. We'll let the readers figure that out and have to read your book for that, Professor. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Michelle. It's my pleasure.
Professor Inderjit Singh is author of The Art and Science of Entrepreneurship, the book we're reading today. This is Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin. Thank you so much for your company.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.